T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
The NBA, Seth, is getting ready to get started back up here at the end of the month, and I was pretty psyched. I saw odds on some games. They actually put spreads out on the first 3 days' worth of games, which made me feel kind of normal again, that there were games I could wager on. You know, it's good to have that sort of normalcy restored in my life, that I could look and see that the Rockets were a 1.5-point favorite over the Dallas Mavericks and place actual American currency down on those games, that I could get down on the Rockets at 10-1 to win the NBA championship, made me feel good again. But probably the thing that made me feel most good was I was reading stories that still made me hate the Utah Jazz as much as I did. You know, you worry that once something like a pandemic gets injected into your sports, that you get a dose of rational thought, that maybe sports gets minimized in terms of its importance and it becomes less a part of your life. I was glad to know that I still feel the same bitter feelings towards other teams in the NBA that I was before the pandemic. Because not only was I seeing spreads on games, but there's Utah Jazz stories floating around, too.
Nobody has handled this pandemic worse than the Utah Jazz, including with Rudy Gobert in his just his casual nonchalance about it at the beginning, to where he was coughing on the microphone and wiping his hands all over everything and then immediately testing positive for it just a couple days later. All of that. And then his teammate Donovan Mitchell still apparently holding a grudge against Rudy Gobert, when it's not entirely clear that Rudy Gobert, right, is the guy that gave it to Donovan Mitchell. It could have been vice versa.
That's the worst part. Like, Rudy Gobert's an infuriating player because he's annoying. He's not funny. He cried when he didn't make the All-Star team, literally was sobbing when he didn't get named to the All-Star team. And then yet here's Donovan Mitchell, who I liked Donovan Mitchell. Like, Donovan Mitchell was a good story. He was the best rookie in his class and was not one of these guys who came into the league as an anointed savior of a franchise. And you go, wow, this guy's a good player. And then, according to the article about the Jazz, he still thinks Rudy Gobert gave him the coronavirus. And to your point, Seth, how the hell does he know it's not vice versa? How does he know Rudy Gobert gave it to him?
Well, they might know just through contact tracing, right? They might have a pretty good idea of it.
Maybe.
Sometimes you can trace it back to whoever gave. I was reading an article about the first case in Italy, which was they found that pretty easily, because that was a woman from China had visited, and she was asymptomatic, by the way.
Maybe.
And that paper got buried for a few weeks before they realized, like, oh wow, asymptomatic. So yeah, I mean, they might have just tracked back to Rudy Gobert being in Europe or something for a short stay and then coming back. I don't know. But the continued anger at it, it's a sign of immaturity to me when you can stay angry at a teammate for an incident like this over multiple months, like, without letting bygones be bygones. And I think Rudy Gobert gave a very seemingly authentic apology about it, and he understood that he was acting irresponsibly, all of that. I feel like it's a bad sign for maturity, but it's a good sign for the Rockets, because I think the Jazz will continue to be a little bit of a disappointment in terms of where their physical ability matches up with their performance.
Of the teams that are in the range where the Rockets would most likely play them in the first round, Oklahoma, Denver, Utah, or Oklahoma City, Denver, and Utah, I think just from purely an intrigue standpoint, it's always fun to play the Jazz because they're hated. Oklahoma City, a 7-game series with Chris Paul on the other side and Russell Westbrook, super intriguing. Denver is probably the one that's least interesting to me, And yet I feel like without having to go to the altitude and play the Denver Nuggets, all of a sudden that might be the most friendly matchup out of those three.
I was actually kind of looking forward to the altitude in Denver because I figured Jokic, who apparently has lost all kinds of weight apparently, would still I feel like Jokic has less of an advantage in that altitude than the Rockets' small ball lineup does. Because Jokic is still a big man trying to run up and down the court with an extremely small lineup. Even though he's acclimatized to it, it's versus much smaller, more athletic dudes.
Yeah.
I would have liked that. So I feel like the Rockets actually miss out on that a little bit. The Jazz, the biggest thing that worries me with the Jazz is that Gobert has been just such a pain in the ass at times in the playoffs versus Harden and his ability to Gobert's good enough that he can even take away the floater. Remember how the playoffs are when we start talking about Harden's floater most heavily because teams will do everything they can to take away Harden at the rim. And that's where you just like, okay, if Harden's floater can get mechanical and perfect and 100%, then you can do something. But Gobert's good enough to even take away the floater. That's where I worry about the Jazz.
He is. They were one team, though, Seth, that the small ball worked against them. Remember Russ drawing Gobert away from the hoop and embarrassing him a few times?
Yeah.
So it'll be an intriguing matchup if that's who they wind up playing. So this is interesting here. So this is almost like some advice for some of these guys as they head into the bubble or they try to get baseball started back up. Seth, you found this one. This is a health expert who's answering the questions on social distancing? These are good questions because I feel like we're still learning about social distancing. This Wall Street Journal article?
Yes. It is Wall Street Journal for a second. Okay. Let's see. So kind of updating because, sometimes you just say, I got to take a break from the news. What should I be doing now? I haven't looked at the news in 2 weeks.
Right.
What's the optimal social distance?
Okay.
This is Dr. Joseph Allen. He says 6 feet is good, but 10 feet is better.
Well,
more space from other people is always better. I think we've almost gotten to the habit now as a society, right, where we take wide berths around people.
Yes.
And nobody takes offense to it.
No.
I generally, if I'm walking on the sidewalk, I used to always step on the grass. I'd try to be the polite person that steps on the grass. Now it's just I'm out in the street, right? I'm going to step in the street. I think most people are like that at this point.
That's what we do. Amy and I in our old neighborhood, we just moved this past week, but in our old neighborhood, our neighborhood had like it was basically constructed around a gigantic circle, like a 2 mile circular road. And then all the little subdivisions were little offshoots of that road. So you get a lot of people walking around that 2 mile circle because you know how long it is and it's an easy walk and this and that. Yeah, we would jump at the very least onto the grass. Sometimes we would play chicken, depending on who the person was. I'm like, let's see if this person wusses out and moves onto the grass for us.
Yeah.
And they never would, and we would wuss out.
You get into that.
Yeah.
When you were younger, did you always have that kind of thing about you? Like, I don't know if it's a youthful insecurity or maybe it's like you're trying to be an alpha male or something, but we're like, you feel like somebody doesn't yield to you enough. Like when you turn your shoulder a little bit as you're walking by and they keep their shoulders square.
Right.
There was always a little part of me. It was like, hey, bro, what the hell?
Yeah.
You think you're better than me?
Yeah.
Somewhere along the way. Okay, so that's normal.
That wasn't just me
being a jerk.
No, that's a normal thing. That's a normal thing. So 6 feet is good, but 10 feet is better. Honestly, this Joseph Allen, who's the director of the Healthy Buildings Program at Harvard.
Yeah.
I could have given that piece of advice. Oh, really? What you're telling me is 10 feet is a better social distance than 6 feet? Thanks, genius.
That's the old, hey, yeah, condom is good, but abstinence is 100%.
Right,
yeah, of
right.
course. Okay, 6 feet is good, but staying completely socially isolated is
right.
better.
So the next question Dr. Allen answers here, Seth, is can we start expanding our social circles?
The good news for both you listening in your car and also people returning to their professional sports leagues, yes, particularly if you're gathering outside and taking proper precautions in terms of distance and masks. This, Dr. Allen says the fewer contacts, the better. But if you're going to start expanding your circle, maybe take into account how careful are the people you're meeting with, too.
Right.
Or have they been out, is this the family that all went clubbing together last night and were, sharing the same Molly water bottle with other club goers, then you don't want to get too, you got to be extra careful with them.
The next question, are elevators risky?
This is the one that hit home because we ride the elevator up and down. And
I now ride it at home on a daily basis as well.
Oh, that's right.
I live on the 15th floor, yeah.
Good. Jeez. Jeez, Sean.
D-Lux apartment in the sky.
Yeah, if you can take the stairs, they say do it. Okay. Sean, did you take the 19 stairs? 19th? Did you take the stairs up to the 19th floor?
To the studio?
This
yeah, no, yeah. I did
you
not
and I
do
are,
that.
You and I are both relatively dry and not still out of breath from a 19 flight.
Did not climb 19 flights. Don't plan to climb 19 flights.
Maybe we should, though. Yeah. Maybe we should. This is what I worry about, though. If too many people start heeding the taking the stairs advice, then what do you have? You've got Seth Payne heavy breathing for 19 flights of stairs, making that stairwell toxic where there is no sunlight to sanitize it, toxic for likely the next 6 to 8 hours.
I remember, Seth, there was one time in the building, I've been here almost 7 years now, and there was a day that, for whatever reason, the building got evacuated, fire drill, something like that. And none of the elevators were working, so everybody had to climb the stairs.
I
do you remember that?
Yes.
Had to climb the stairs back to the 19th floor. I mean, they could have made an episodic documentary about the people at Entercom having to climb back. There were people by the 10th floor. There are people stopping to rest. They're wait, you're walking past people who are winded. I was half expecting people to be standing at the 12th floor holding out cups of water like a 5K. For you, and you grab them and you dump it on yourself as you go to the next floor.
It was like Stairmageddon in the last season of The Office.
Yes,
when Stanley refused to go back downstairs, so they hit him with tranquilizers.
That's right.
and slid him down.
That's right.
I think Dwight, by the way, the last season of The Office was actually one of my favorite.
Really?
I thought the evolution of Dwight Schrute was one of the coolest things I've seen. And then him and his relationship with the little Dwight Jr.
Clark,
I really like that dynamic. I thought that could have been a spinoff. I thought Dwight could have had like five different spinoffs from that series.
Oh, I hated the last season. Seth, I had The Office on in the background in my apartment this weekend, and I'm putting a new headboard together for our master bedroom by myself because Amy's at a bachelorette party, and it's got one of those wonky little wrenches that come with it to put it together, and I'm having a hard time putting it together because I'm one person holding up pieces, and this last season of The Office was playing in the background, and it made me hate that season even more. I'm like, I hated this season of The Office, and now that I'm actually doing physical labor here and putting something together, which I suck at, I hate it even more, so I turned it off.
I think the series got better after Steve Carell left.
Really?
Uh-huh.
I don't know that I've disagreed with you more over anything than this. That's
I usually I'm one that hates sitcoms when they start to get a little too, like, I don't like it when characters evolve generally. If it was a silly goofy sitcom at the beginning, I want it to be a silly goofy sitcom at the end. The Office is one exception where the fact that the characters evolved, I thought it made the show better. Steve Carell leaving allowed them to do that.
Okay, maybe. That may be true because they had to fill that gap because he was obviously, the show was built around him. I don't know, man. I just, that last couple seasons felt cluttered. It felt like one of those NBA trades. It felt like the Chris Paul trade. Remember where the Rockets trade for Chris Paul, and they give the Clippers like seven guys in return. But you would argue that trade actually worked out well for the Clippers, and it worked out well for The Office, too. They traded Steve Carell, and they got Clark and Plop and the chick with the British accent. They got Spader for a little while. David Wallace came back.
The woman from with the British accent I knew from watching Doctor Who, too. Yeah. So I got excited to see her.
Seth, last question. Is it safe to take a summer vacation?
Oh, yes, he answers emphatically, this nice Dr. Allen. He says, for one, camping is okay, just being careful. But we need to get out and about in the world for our mental health. Yeah. We should take advantage of the summer when we can be outdoors because we don't know what the winter is going to bring. And he predicts that this will be the year of the RV. I wonder if RV prices have skyrocketed.
I don't know.
With all of this. Yeah. A lot of people just figuring, hey, take an RV out somewhere, find some camping site where it's not overly crowded, and just have a good time of it.
That's I like that answer mostly because you and I are taking a summer vacation next week. Not together, but we're both taking vacation next week. Yeah,
yeah. You turned down my invitation to come along on our summer vacation.
How much easier will it be to hit 400 for this season in baseball now that it's only 60 games? And do the Astros have a shot of having a guy? We'll have that next. A lot of people weighing in, Seth, on your bumping into somebody's shoulder take. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Text in 713-572-4610. So, shortened season in Major League Baseball. And I think, Seth, baseball more than any other sport has these hallowed numbers that if you know that baseball is the topic and you name a number, then you can almost, if you watch the sport enough, you can guess what exactly it is you're talking about, whether it's a quantity of home runs or maybe a benchmark for a season, whatever the case may be. 400 is one of those hallowed numbers, batting average. The last person to do it, Ted Williams, in a full season in 1941. So it's been...
Right before he went off to war.
Yeah, he was 22 years old.
He might have had more, perhaps.
Yeah, he was 22 years old when he did it. And so Ted Williams, the last one to do it for a full season. But this is a 60-game season, and so this will be the full season. So,
and this is the news that people are not going to be happy to hear about, Sean. I'm going to tell them right now. The name... The guy perhaps most likely and most recently that could have pulled it off in a 60-game season, Cody Bellinger.
Mm.
Cody Bellinger last year had a 400 batting average midway through game 50.
Okay.
I think he had one hit at that point or something. I don't think he finished the game with a 400 batting average, but he did have a 400 batting average, and he flirted with it at various times up until that point. But he went as late as the 50th game of the season with a 400 batting average. So in a 60-game season, very, very possible.
Here are the players who, since 1942, so since Ted Williams hit 400 in a season, here are the players who were batting 400 through 60 team games, right? So through 60 games, their team, so maybe they hadn't played in all 60 games, but their team had played 60 games into the season, from the start of the season through the 60-game mark since 1942. Chipper Jones, 2008, 409. Tony Gwynn, 1997, 403. Larry Walker, same year, 1997, he had 417. Paul O'Neill, in 1994, that would be the strike-shortened season, but through 60 games, he was hitting 417.
Tony Gwynn had a really good year in 94, too.
He did.
400 a bunch of times.
Yep. I think he wound up hitting 394 that year for the short. That was the year Bagwell won the MVP. Rod Carew, 1983, he hit 411. Hank Aaron, in 1959, was hitting 402 through 60 games. And then Ted Williams himself hitting 412 through 60 games in 1948. So it hasn't happened very often. It's happened four times since the mid-90s. Now, there have been a larger handful of players who have had 60-game stints within a season where they've been able to hit, you know, starting at the beginning of June and going through early August, that kind of thing. And Jose Altuve in his MVP season, I mean, if you remember back to the summer of 2017, in July, Jose Altuve hit like 500 that year. He was ridiculous.
He was unconscious on the road.
He had a 60-game stretch in 2017 where he hit 420.
Yeah.
So Jose Altuve, in this article I'm looking at, he's the very first one they list among superstar players who might be able to pull this thing off. Now, Seth, Jose Altuve has not come close to the averages he was putting up when he was winning batting titles, but he still hit 318 in 2018, and last year, where he was injured for a big chunk of the year, he was at 298. Do you think Jose Altuve has a season in him where he could hit 400 over 60 games?
I think he totally does, and I think that he's one of the guys that's going to most benefit from having this long extended break. Because that, you know, the other thing that's happened to the Astros over these last few years is, man, it's a lot of extra baseball every year. And then it ends up being a lot less recovery in the offseason. And then Jose Altuve, we've seen that classic cycle, right, where he got injured, he was playing with a broken kneecap, came back after that season, ends up pulling his hamstring, ends up having other issues, where it just seems like everything, like all these biomechanical imbalances are just passing the injury around his body. He could really use that break. And then in a shortened season, there's less of a chance that he's going to have to, you know, sit out a good chunk with some kind of minor injury. So yeah, I think he totally does. I think it would be awesome in a lot of respects, just because it would anger the rest of the baseball world so much. But also, I think hopefully maybe lend some credence to the accurate argument that he wasn't wearing a buzzer in 2019.
Oh, yeah.
I just think there's too many people that they don't really stop to think about it at all. They've got that picture in their mind that ESPN circulates nonstop of him wagging his finger, and people just assume that he was actually wearing a buzzer. I think in a lot of people's minds, that's almost like an indisputable fact, when it's exactly the opposite. I think that this year and then next season and a full season, hopefully, he can really reverse course on a lot of that groupthink.
Yeah, that's another sign that baseball is almost back, is that they were coming out of the woodwork again this weekend. You know, you root for a team that cheated. Oh, that must be fun, knowing what pitch is coming. the gif of Altuve, as you just said, Seth, clutching his jersey after the the walk-off home run. They're back.
Which,
those people are
back.
By
the way, I feel like I need to remember, I got to reiterate sometimes to our own fans, because sometimes people themselves kind of checked out on a lot of the Astros stuff. And maybe I'll recirculate this this video. There are multiple instances of Jose Altuve trying not to have his teammates rip his jersey off going back to 2015, long before Carlos Beltran got there and taught them how to cheat. It was kind of a running gag with them that they were going to try to take his jersey off. So, and then the tattoo story checks out. Like, all of these things check out. All the arguments that he wasn't wearing a buzzer make way more sense than the argument that he was wearing a buzzer.
The other players listed in the article I'm looking at, superstar players who could hit 400 this year. We mentioned Altuve. You mentioned Bellinger earlier. He's listed. 370 was the batting average he had for his highest 60-game stretch in 2019. Cody Bellinger, DJ LeMahieu, who's on the Yankees, who presumably the Astros are going to have to get through to get to the World Series. And then, Seth, this is something that had slipped my mind as the offseason was rolling on, because it's been such a weird offseason, is that Mike Trout and Anthony Rendon, both listed in this article, are now batting back-to-back in the middle of the Angels order.
It's going to be fun.
That's
scary. It's going to be fun. this Western heavy schedule that we have here, the Angels games have taken on a whole lot of juice this year.
Yeah, that's true. Bellinger is going to be on the schedule now, too. So these are all guys who factor into the Astros season. Seth, you're getting a lot of reaction to your talking about social distancing on the sidewalk when going for a walk and you're walking towards two people. You know, who's going to, you know, just playing chicken, who's going to give.
But wait, I was talking about not even in social distance, in normal social situations pre-COVID, where when you walk past somebody and you turn your shoulder, but you realize that they didn't turn your shoulder.
Right.
And you're like, what the hell? Like, oh, I didn't know this was an alpha male competition.
Yeah.
You almost want a do-over, right? Where you can go back and like, oh, I'll gladly not turn my shoulder for you, bro.
Yeah.
A lot of people saying, I thought maybe I was insecure or something for having that feeling. Getting a lot of people backing up. Let's see. He said, this one guy says the one time he decided not to yield and he wasn't going to do it because he didn't think this guy was going to turn his shoulder. He ended up knocking the guy over.
Oh, my God. As a bigger guy, I'm always seeing some dude trying to walk by me bowed up and not trying to squeeze by.
Yeah, it happens a lot. Like, a lot of times the smaller guy, for whatever reason, feels like he needs to prove himself. And, at some point in my life, it used to bother me, and now it doesn't bother me at all, except that I think less of that person. Like, I think, especially if they're an adult, like, dude, if you're my age, you're in your 40s, come on, man, like, what are we gonna do? We're gonna go out behind to the flagpole or something? What are you doing here?
Did you ever feel like you were a target as a football player? You know, in your younger days, you're out at bars and things like that. And
It's the one time, the biggest incident we ever had was this kid, Dave Kempfert, who's a practice squad offensive lineman. And we were hanging out in a bar, and Dave was like the nicest guy in the world. But this guy, Dave was talking to some girl, and apparently this guy knew the girl, but Dave was having a nice conversation with him. And this guy comes up out of nowhere and like cold cocks Dave Kempfert, and all of immediately, you know, like, everybody rushes to try to break up this fight, and they're about to kick Dave Kempfert, my friend, out, and everybody around him said, no, this guy was like totally the culprit. But meanwhile, my brother, who is very good, and he was kind of the guy that kept everybody from getting in trouble or anything when we went out. He was almost like the shepherd of all of us.
Yeah.
He basically like grabs Dave, gets him out of there, grabs all of us, gets us out to the Suburban. And then this is where my brother Dan wasn't as good as he would later, you know, now he's a very respectable adult. Here he was like a 24-year-old, 25-year-old kid. He gets us all out into my Suburban. He's like, hold on, I got to go back and get my credit card. He says he's going back to get his credit card. What he does is he goes back into the bar, finds this guy who's talking to a circle of people about how he just beat the crap out of this NFL football player. And my brother was like, that was you? And the guy was like, yeah. And my brother goes, that was awesome. And then, bam.
Your brother cold cocked
him? Pops him in the face, yeah. Comes back out to the car. And like, my brother's knuckles were all bloody from hitting his teeth.
Oh,
like,
they had just, oh, yeah. Geez.
My brother could handle himself. And then off we went. So he was kind of a pretty good escort, but not the best escort.
Did he knock out some of the guy's chiclets? Did he not?
Probably. Yeah,
really?
Probably. I don't know. He didn't stick around to admire his handiwork. He got moving.
Okay, but
he
did
just,
that
he figured at that point, this guy's got friends. I'm going to get out of here.
So it never came back to roost, though, right? Like they never.
No, no, no.
Okay.
If there's one thing you need to know about my brother, is that he's probably, again, very respectable adult. This is all 20, 30, 40 years ago, Sean. For a guy that was mischievous as all get out, I don't know if he ever got in trouble for anything. He had an uncanny ability to be the guy that was like first to recognize that that the authorities were coming, and then he'd be off on his merry way.
That is an instinct. That's a gift. That kind of instinct.
Well, plus he'd always, you know what it was? He was a really good wrestler. I mean, he was a an internationally ranked wrestler.
Yeah.
So he was really good at when somebody would try to. But he's also a wise ass. He'd get into fights. But then he would just kind of get people to submit. He would fight them until they got tired out, and he would just like kind of lay on them a little while, and then he'd turn it into a joke. So there were a lot of times bigger guys tried to beat the crap out of him, and he would just kind of tire them out and dance around.
Yeah, man.
And maybe hit him with a fireman's carry, then they'd have drinks together.
That wrestling background, that helps. The signing of Cam Newton with the New England Patriots continues a very, very intriguing trend in the AFC. We will tell you what it is next. So the Cam Newton signing in New England essentially completes what is functionally a four-team trade of quarterbacks. Cam winds up going from Carolina to New England. He was forced out in Carolina with the signing of Teddy Bridgewater, who left the backup job in New Orleans to take that job. Well, Jameis Winston fills the backup job in New Orleans because Tom Brady was signed as the starter in Tampa Bay, and that created the space for Cam Newton to sign there. So it's basically a four-team functional trade of quarterbacks between the Bucks, Saints. Yeah, it's wife swap.
It's not a trade because they don't the Panthers get nothing for Cam Newton because he didn't do anything for them last year. Like they won't get a compensatory pick or anything.
No. But just from purely those four teams essentially took their four quarterbacks and sort of swapped them around. So it's just a weird coincidence more than anything else. But Seth, what I was leading into was, as I'm thinking about this, I'm going, man, this has been an offseason that's been NBA-like almost, where with star players, quarterbacks that are on different teams with Rivers in Indianapolis and Brady in Tampa and now Cam in New England. When we're talking guys who were MVPs not all that long ago at the position that has seemingly been the position in team sports where there's been very little shuffling. Interesting fact, in the AFC, and going through the 16 starting quarterbacks, likely starting quarterbacks in the AFC, I'm going to assume Cam is that guy in New England, but even if it's Stidham, this still holds true. 14 of the 16 teams in the AFC, Seth, will be starting the season with starting quarterbacks who have been the guy for three seasons or less in that city. And that, Rivers has been around forever, but this is his first season in Indianapolis. Cam's been around forever. This is his first season in New England. The only two quarterbacks who have been the guy at starting quarterback in the AFC for longer than prior to 2017, Derek Carr in Las Vegas and Ben Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh. Other than that, think about all the teams. It's all guys who are either brand new to their teams, veteran guys, or it's guys who are young quarterbacks who aren't even to their second contract yet.
Yeah.
That's wild to me.
Carr hasn't even been in the same city. You can't even stick around in the same city.
Yeah. That's crazy to me considering just the importance of the quarterback position.
Well, but I guess that's where the fact that there is more talent overall. Like, it's not as top-heavy at the quarterback position as it had been for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think at least part of that is that NFL coaches finally blessedly understood that, this running element really can go a long way. You can actually win Super Bowls with quarterbacks that are really adept at running, and they don't have to necessarily be incredible passers. That let's use every bit of athletic skill a quarterback has, and then lo and behold, you've got more. And then you've got the fact that all these kids have been playing 7-on-7 since they were 12 years old. And they've just simply had more reps throwing the football. I think this is the new normal. It's not like this is a weird year where it was a lot like the NBA. There is a greater supply of quarterbacks now, and teams are going to get, they're going to do two things. One, they know that they can go out and find quarterbacks elsewhere, which makes them, two, less likely to be patient with their own quarterback. It used to be, look at the Jaguars. The Jaguars kind of did it the old school way where they said, well, we don't really know what we have with Blake Bortles, so let's go ahead and we'll draft Leonard Fournette and give Blake Bortles an extension. How stupid is that?
Yeah.
Think about all the quarterbacks they could have gone and gotten, not just in the draft, but elsewhere. All the guys we just talked about that were better than Blake Bortles. Yeah, there will be more trades. And both because guys want to go out and get them, but also because guys are going to get sick of their own quarterbacks.
Yeah. So Deshaun Watson's one of the most tenured quarterbacks in the AFC if you count tenure as starting for the team that you're on right now. It's like 2017. It's Carr in 2014, Roethlisberger in 2004, and then the most tenured quarterback for the team that he plays for is Deshaun Watson 2017. That's wild to me. That's a weird kind of anomaly. Dan Orlovsky just tweeted this about Cam Newton, Seth, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. He said the Patriots' offense for 20 years dominant because of detailed execution. Their calling card now will be about, quote, confusion. And he cites one of the examples for the Patriots deploying confusion as their game plan as the Week 3 win over the Texans in 2016. The Thursday night game when Brock Osweiler was the quarterback, where the Texans, who were 2-0 at the time, traveled to New England on a Thursday night. That was during the Deflategate suspension. And Garoppolo had been the starter for the first couple games. He got hurt. So Jacoby Brissett, as a rookie, was starting in Week 3, and the Patriots took the Texans to the woodshed. They shut him out, like 26-0 or something like that. And Jacoby Brissett, he did a lot of damage on the ground in that game. I remember the one touchdown he had that was on, I think, sort of a zone read kind of deal, and the Texans were naked on one end of the field, and he ran it in for a really long touchdown. He cites that game as an example of the Patriots using confusion as opposed to detailed execution. Do you agree with Orlovsky in terms of what the calling card is going to be for the Patriots now with Cam Newton, or are they going to be able to still run some of the stuff they used to do?
Well, I think that there's this. I think that Orlovsky is, I guess, maybe with more of an old-school quarterback mindset. He's talking about precision in the passing game. I think it would be foolish to think that you can just go out there and run a Cam Newton-style offense and not have any attention to detail or actually be really precise in the running game. And because they're both intertwined. So, yes, it's going to be a different level of precision. But I think it'll be a different type of precision. So Tom Brady has this orchestra going on in the passing game where the receivers are all adjusting their routes based on coverages. He's organizing the pass protection at the line of scrimmage. He's doing all these things where it's like he's conducting a symphony. It's going to be, I think with Cam Newton, it'll be more like a jam band, you know, where it's a little bit more of like, all right, there's where we want to go. Let's do it. But you can't run those plays without a lot of precision amongst the offensive line, without your wide receivers knowing how to block, where to block, when to block, all of that, and then have your quarterback operating at a high level too. I think they'll still – it's Bill Belichick. Whether it's Cam Newton or Jarrett Stidham, they're going to be running that offense with precision. It's just going to look different than Dan Orlovsky's, you know, nocturnal emission dream.
Yeah, that's – okay. That's
I don't know if I could say the other word.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying.
I use the medical term.
That game too was an extreme example. That was Jacoby Brissett's first start in the NFL. So by definition, it was confusion because nobody had any film on him at an NFL level outside of maybe some preseason stuff of Jacoby Brissett. Through the air, they were 11 of 19 for 103 yards in that game. That's not going to be what they're – I mean, Cam Newton's going to throw the football.
Yeah, what does Orlovsky think that – no, then –
They ran the ball 39 times in that game.
This is the problem, yes. Jacoby Brissett worked partly because nobody knew what the hell they were going to get out of Jacoby Brissett. Brissett's not a great athlete, so I think a lot of us going into that game were saying, like, look, whatever your preconceptions are, it's not going to be like a zone read style or something.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, he gets him with a quarterback run.
Right.
So, yeah, there was some confusion there. That wasn't really in the scouting report for Jacoby Brissett, and the Patriots used that to their advantage. There will be scouting reports on Cam Newton.
Yeah.
There's going to be some wrinkles and whatnot with what the Patriots do, but teams know what they're getting with Cam Newton. They're not going to be able to go out there and bamboozle somebody every single week, and Orlovsky knows better than that.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what his whole entire point is.
Yeah.
I'm sure they want you to tune into SportsCenter to find out.
Well, and it was a tweet, so we caveat that with he's doing this in 280 characters or less.
Yeah.
You know, if he had a chance to give some nuance to it, then then maybe he illustrates the point a little bit differently.
Well, I think, though, too, part of the problem is, okay, what is confusion? I mean, that's what football is, including in the precise passing game. It's confusion. It's creating confusion amongst defensive backs with what route combinations are coming. It's creating confusion as to whether it's a run or a pass. So when you use play action really effectively, it's all confused. That's what it's been. Sean, this was, you know what they did? They had to ban certain things in the 1800s because football teams were trying to like sew pockets into their jerseys so you could hide the football. There were football colored jerseys. It's always been about creating confusion.
Sure. I think it's, you know, maybe safe to say, Seth, that the teams that are at a disadvantage going against Cam Newton, again, assuming he's healthy, are the ones at the beginning of the year. Because, yeah, you've got film on Cam Newton, but you don't have film on tendencies that the Patriots are using with Cam Newton, right? Like, you know, the longer the season goes on, the more you have film of Cam Newton operating in a Josh McDaniels offense. Just for that purpose, these are the teams that the Patriots play early in the season. They open at home against the Dolphins. They travel to Seattle to face the Seahawks in week two in a Sunday night game. They play the Raiders in week three in New England, and then they're at Kansas City in week four in a late afternoon Sunday game. So that's kind of exciting because we know that Lamar Jackson, Mahomes, and Watson all face off against each other the first 3 weeks of the year, sort of a round-robin deal. Cam Newton goes against Mahomes in week four, so we got a lot of juicy matchups in the AFC through the first 4 weeks.
I'm genuinely excited to watch the Patriots this year. I feel a little bit dirty about it because forever it was just, oh, man, oh, when can Tom Brady just retire or leave? I'm getting so tired of this. This feels different because I feel like even if it works out really well, it's going to be a couple of years at max. And also that it's not clear yet, unless I missed something this morning, whether the Patriots would be able to franchise tag Cam Newton or not. Just because, you know, Clowney had an agreement with the Seahawks that they wouldn't franchise tag him. Right. Maybe that was part of one of the agreements here, which I think that even has to be kind of an oral agreement. I don't think it's necessarily allowed under the CBA. It's just a, you know, yeah, bro, we'll do you solid.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, which you can hold teams to that generally if they do something like that.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the Patriots schedule. They play the Texans in week 10 in NRG Stadium. How about this for a three-game stretch, Seth? They play this is weeks 9, 10, and 11 for the Patriots. They play Lamar Jackson and the Ravens in week 9. They play Deshaun Watson and the Texans in week 10. And then they play Kyler Murray in week 11. It's a lot of running around for that Patriot defense.
That is, isn't it?
Right?
That,
and you're a former defensive lineman. What would you think looking at the schedule, seeing, and actually 2 weeks before that, they played Josh Allen, too. So.
Well, you know what? I mean, obviously with any of those quarterbacks, there's always just the X factor of, man, you could be playing a great game, and then all of a sudden they bust one out. Just like Deshaun versus the Bills, and your whole day is ruined, you know?
Yep.
I think with Cam going to the Patriots, what I'm interested in seeing is there's a little bit of perhaps the same element of Mike Vick going to the Eagles where Vick made, you know, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Vick made some changes to his game late in his career when playing for a different coordinator, when playing for Andy Reid. And he made some, you know, I think, strides and progress that a lot of people didn't think Mike Vick could do. I think maybe Cam Newton, as much as we're talking about how the Patriots are going to mold their defense to Cam Newton, I think there are some things that Cam Newton has probably never been asked to do that Belichick and Josh McDaniels will ask him to do. And I think Cam might surprise some people as to how well he adapts to it. Because he's been, look, Cam's had a couple years of kind of been getting kicked in the dirt and thinking like, all right, whatever it takes, I want to come back and do it. And he might be in the perfect mindset right now to accept coaching from Josh McDaniels.
How much do you think his injury history affects the way they use him? And I ask that because as he was getting more and more banged up in his time in Carolina, there was a lot of debate and discussion. Should Carolina be running him the way that they have for his whole time there? You know, Cam probably ran more between the tackles than any quarterback in the history of the game because he was such a gigantic human being. How cognizant of that do you think the Patriots will be? And how much do you have to look at it and go, is Cam really Cam if we're not using him as a guy who's, you know, running designed runs 8 to 10 times a game?
I think it goes back to the classic rules that, I mean, it's really only been the past decade that there have been so many dual threat quarterbacks. But the general rule is, hey, if your quarterback runs twice a game convincingly, it affects everything else. It affects everything else. Like the defenses worry about it. Defenses have to account for it. And Belichick knows that. So I don't think it's going to be like Shanahan was with RG3 his rookie year, where they were running him, using him as a receiver, doing all that stuff. They're gonna be very careful and judicious with how they use it. And I think Belichick has probably got more self-discipline when it comes to stuff like that than any other coach in history. He's always got the long-term in mind as he's taking care of short-term issues. So I think he'll be careful with that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I go back and look at Vic, Seth. You brought it up. Look at Vic, the 2009 is when he was first with the Eagles, but he played wide receiver for the most part that year. And then he was the starting quarterback the next season, and that was when he got his big contract, right? That was when he, in 2010, that's when he had a breakout Andy Reid year. He rushed the ball 100 times in 12 games, and he led the league in average yards per attempt with nearly 7 yards per attempt. And they went 8-3 with Vic as the starting quarterback. And we remember the next offseason was the one where they signed Nnamdi Asamoah. They signed Cullen Jenkins. They signed Vince Young to be the backup quarterback. And Vince Young made the infamous dream team comment. For whatever reason, you know, I didn't watch a ton of Eagles football that year. Vic was running the ball a lot less the next year. And the Eagles were 7-6 with him as the starting quarterback. So, yeah. You know, just that threat and being able to deploy it is so big, and being able to get out there and execute the offense the way you want to, especially when a guy's not necessarily a precision-type passer. So Cam Newton is a New England Patriot, one-year incentive-laden contract.
Wheatstraw points out that perhaps me saying you can't teach an old dog new tricks wasn't the best analogy to use with Michael Vick. And, you know, what's funny is, like, you know, given the current times, I'm kind of like, wait a second. Let me check my, what is this? Did I say something inappropriate? Oh, yeah, the dog thing. Yeah, that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah. No, that's animal insensitive is what that is. Yeah. So, let's see here. One other news item with the Patriots we should mention is the punishment that they got for filming the Cincinnati Bengals sideline.
Oh, yeah, we should mention that because it's been swept under the rug yet again.
Frequently. We cannot be part of the problem and sweep it under the rug.
It's been swept under the rug twice now, where the NFL swept it under the rug for us in the regular season. It just kind of mysteriously went away, right? The Bengals, or excuse me, for those of you that aren't aware of the case, the Patriots had a film crew separate from the football team. One of Bob Kraft's little media productions was following one of the Patriots' advanced scouts around, doing a documentary on him. And they were supposedly in documenting what this scout does, which is look at the opposing team's hand signals, signs from the sideline. The film crew filmed those opposing team scouts or coaches as well, which is a big no-no. And it kind of just went away silently during the season. Now, on the same day that Cam Newton gets signed, they also announced that the Patriots are losing a third-round pick and $1.1 million because they shouldn't have done what they did.
Do you? It's almost like a presidential election cycle or the Olympics, where like every 4 years we just have to have a New England Patriot punishment for something, for some scofflaw football reason. Do you think they have an open tab with the league office, Seth? Like, do you think when they found out the punishment, that Roger Goodell or Troy Vincent or whoever's calling Robert Kraft asked him, is your tab still open, sir? Did you close it out with Deflategate? Well, and Kraft's like, no, my tab is still open with the league. Just put the $1.1 million on my tab.
Meanwhile, we haven't even mentioned Bob Kraft's, you know, massage parlor,
right?
His budget massage parlor. Remember we were talking earlier about how billionaires still pinch pennies? Like, this is what Bob Kraft's doing for his jollies, right? Is going to like some seedy massage
Orchids
parlor.
Orchids of Asia,
He's being very careful. Why would he spend big time money the way the other rich people do? Yep. I do wonder if part of Tom Brady, aside from just wanting to, you know, spread his wings a little bit and have a new challenge, I wonder if there's any part of him that's like, you know, I really want to show that I can do this away from all this other stuff that Belichick's been doing.
All the chicanery.
I don't think Brady was probably really aware of any of the Spygate stuff or anything.
Yeah.
You know? But then Belichick's reportedly got all huffy about Brady getting caught up in Deflategate. Like Belichick was some virtuous dude or something that had any right to judge. I bet Tom Brady a little bit is like, you know what? Bruce Arians never been accused of anything except maybe having too good a time.
Right.
Let's just go ahead and let's rock this out with no cheating.
It was an historic anniversary yesterday for trades in the city of Houston. We'll talk about that next.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.